are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months.
Always for them, duty, honor, country.
Has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba.
The war in Vietnam.
We will not turn, we will not falter, and we will not fail.
Welcome to the American Military History Podcast. I'm your host, Justin, and this is episode 41, The Battle of Saratoga, part 3, Bemis Heights. This will be part 38 of our series on the Revolutionary War. And before we begin this week's episode, just a reminder that the podcast is fully listener-supported. If you feel that this episode is worth a dollar or two, consider donating to support the podcast. More information can be found at the end of this episode or on the homepage, AmericanMilitaryHistoryPodcast.com. Once there, click on the green button that says Support the Podcast for more information. Last week's episode ended with the conclusion of what is referred to as the First Battle of Saratoga, which we kind of named the Battle of Freeman's Farm. And you'll see historians throw those names back and forth, just like they will with this week's episode, which is technically referred to as both the Second Battle of Saratoga and the Battle of Bemis Heights. But at the conclusion of the Battle of Freeman's Farm last week, British General John Burgoyne had called off his attack and ordered his units to dig in along the same general lines that they had occupied during the battle, while he awaited the results of Sir Henry Clinton's operations. Operations that Burgoyne had learned about in a dispatch that very day. Now, I ended the podcast by stating that it would be a fatal mistake for Burgoyne. Today, we'll find out why. As the month of September carried on, American commander Horatio Gates's luck continued to increase. 2 months prior, in July, the murder of a young woman named Jane McCrae, which we talked about in part one of our discussion on Saratoga, was one of the single largest events that fueled patriotism in the North. Now, if you haven't listened to part one yet, A, shame on you. B, the short version is that a Native American that was part of the British unit in the area under Burgoyne's command had murdered and supposedly scalped a young American woman. Volunteers from the surrounding countryside began pouring into Gates's camp on Bemis Heights and General Lincoln's camp in Vermont. The new recruits came in their civilian clothes, each with their family musket, and often with their own ammunition. By the end of September, General Lincoln had arrived at Bemis Heights and merged his forces with Gates, which brought militia strength up to about 4,300 men. However, by the end of the first week of October, Gates's total strength was around 11,000 men, with only 2,700 of those being Continentals. The rest were militia. Gates possessed the personnel, but he also possessed a personnel problem, Benedict Arnold. Two more divergent personalities seldom clashed than those two did after Freeman's Farm. John R. Elting, in his work, The Battle of Saratoga, describes the situation as follows. The two men were utterly different personalities, but their quarrel undoubtedly had its beginning somewhere in Gates's enigmatic character, a man who could display the frowsy manners of an ill-bred boor on relieving schooler, would not likely to tolerate an aggressive, independent subordinate as Benedict Arnold. Arnold's righteous anger at Gates for refusing to support him at Freeman's Farm was followed by other incidents. First, Gates transferred Morgan and Dearborn from Arnold's to his own personal command. There was also a case of misassignment of three New York militia regiments, which Arnold had been assured would go to Poor's brigade in his division, but instead went to another. The real rift between the two came when Gates's letter to Congress, reporting on the battle from the 19th of September, failed to mention Arnold or even Morgan or Dearborn. And if you'll recall from our last episode, it was Arnold's aggressiveness and his boldness on the field that first engaged and bloodied the enemy, not Gates's hesitation. Always super sensitive to slights against his character or reputation, Arnold was enraged. Now, Gates could have been the general in command here and taken the high road. He could have been the better man. He wasn't. When Arnold brought his concerns to Gates, Gates's response was to bait the furious Arnold by expressing doubt that Arnold really held a commission in the Continental Army. Gates also hinted that command of the left wing, until then Arnold's command, was to be given to General Lincoln. Gates dug the knife in even further. In a general order dated 25th of September, he appointed Lincoln to command the right wing while Gates assumed personal command of the left, which left Arnold with no command at all. Throughout the whole affair, there had been an exchange of quibbling and foolish letters that had only served to build up rancor on both sides. Think of it today like somebody posting something stupid on Facebook and then getting in an argument with somebody being even stupider. And that's basically what these two were doing back and forth with their letters that they were sending. In Isaac N. Arnold's words, in his work, The Life of Benedict Arnold, Gates was irritating, arrogant, and vulgar. Arnold, indiscreet, haughty, and passionate. After the issuance of the order on the 25th of September, Arnold stayed in his command post, a general without any command or without any function. Now, while Gates and Arnold had pulled out rulers and decided to have an impromptu measuring contest, Burgoyne was busy organizing and constructing entrenchments across his front from the Hudson to the high ground northwest of Freeman's Farm. A system of redoubts with extended trenches covered the Army's 2.5-mile front. The so-called Great Redoubt anchored the left, or the east rear. A little over a half-mile to its front, other entrenchments, outposts, were constructed near the river and south of the Great Ravine. Those were to protect the stores and bateau, as well as secure the Army's left. Farther west, the Balcarres Redoubt had been built just south of Freeman's Farm. Still further west, the extreme right of Burgoyne's line curved back around a low hill northwest of the Balcarres Redoubt. There, a U-shaped fortification called the Brayman Redoubt, facing generally southwestward, secured the Army's right. The gap between the two redoubts was covered only by some Canadians occupying two fortified cabins in a clearing. Now, I know that was a lot of information to throw at you. Check the website for maps that will show you how all this is laid out. On the American side, there had been only one significant fortification addition. The high ground of Fort Nielsen, which, remember, was actually a farmhouse that the men had fortified and dubbed it a fort. And it was this high ground near Fort Nielsen that had been Burgoyne's main objective in his advance on the 19th of September. Now, the Americans had entrenched and occupied that high ground at this point. Thus, a potential threat from the direction of that terrain, to the Americans at least, had been eliminated. Burgoyne called a council of war on the 4th of October, and there were certain aspects that he and his generals did not need to discuss. They all understood it already. Number one, for some time now, the only food had been flour and salt pork. Number two, only the day before, the 3rd of October, food rations, consisting of flour and salt pork, had been cut in half, again. Number three, horses were dying due to lack of forage. Number four, desertions added to battlefield losses and reduced the Army's effectiveness from 8,000 to 5,000. Number five, the Americans were giving Burgoyne and his men little time for rest. In Burgoyne's own words, "Not a night passed without firing, and sometime concerted attacks at our advanced pickets. It was the plan of the enemy to harass the Army by constant alarms, and their superiority of number enabled them to attempt it without fatigue to themselves." Despite all of this, Burgoyne had devised a bold plan of action that he began to lay out before Phillips, Riedesel, and Fraser. The plan called for 800 men to be left to defend the army's boats and supplies, and the rest of the army he would move to turn the American left and attack it in flank and rear. To the three generals, the plan seemed more than bold. It seemed desperate, without any guarantee of success. Now, because of the dense woods and the enemy's almost impenetrable security, the British had no adequate intelligence of the American positions. Moreover, to risk the army's last stores to destruction or capture by an American threat while Burgoyne's columns were entangled in the forest was an unacceptable loss. Riedesel proposed an alternative, a retreat to their former positions at Fort Miller, where they could maintain a line of communications with Canada, and at the same time be in position to act in conjunction with Clinton if he made his advance. Burgoyne rejected the idea of a retreat while the men were still able to fight. Eventually, Burgoyne presented a new plan to the council, this time for more of a large-scale reconnaissance in force. Now, his plan was very similar to that of his advance on the 19th of September, which was the plan that kicked off Freeman's Farm. The men were to move in three columns, but this time he would employ fewer than half the army's rank on file, which would be about 1,500 regulars and some 600 auxiliaries, for a total force of around 2,000-2,100 men. The main objective was that same magnet, the same thing that had been drawing him time and time again, the high ground to the American left above Fort Neilson. Now, he determined that they should feel out that position to determine whether a major attack could still be made from that direction. Now, apparently, the thwarted British intelligence efforts had also failed to reveal that the Americans had by then occupied and fortified that high ground. Now, if you missed last week's episode, or if you're just not following, the reason that that high ground is so important is it overlooks the entire American position. So Gates wants to get up there so that Burgoyne can't. Now, Gates is there, and he's fortified, but Burgoyne doesn't know that yet. Burgoyne wants to get there because if he can get there and put his artillery on it, he can rain down into the American fortifications and do some damage. Now, Burgoyne's intent was first to determine whether the American left was still assailable, which means he can still get to that high ground and attack them. And if that was the case, he was to seize the high ground, and from there he could launch a main attack, which would be preceded by heavy artillery and break through or around the American left. Now, if the reconnaissance revealed that a major attack was unfeasible, Burgoyne would order a withdrawal of the army northeastward to the Baton Kill. Now, this new plan was adopted and accepted by his generals, and on the morning of the 7th of October, the columns were forming up. And although the scarlet coats of the British line were faded and torn, and undoubtedly dirty at this point, the overall turnout was indeed very soldierly and somewhat patriotic for the British. Musket barrels and bayonets reflected the bright sun of a very pleasant morning, as ranks were dressed before falling into column. Sometime after 10 a.m., the three columns marched out of the Balcarres Redoubt near Freeman's Farm, advancing 3/4 of a mile to the southwest. The right column, led by Major Balcarres, was made up of the light infantry companies. The center column, commanded by Riedesel, contained picked detachments of Brunswickers, who would be wearing dark blue uniforms, not scarlet ones, for those of you keeping tabs at home, as well as Brayman's Jaegers and the British 24th Regiment. On the right of Riedesel's column marched Major Auckland's Grenadiers. The force was followed by 10 artillery pieces, 6 6-pounders, 2 12-pounders, and 2 howitzers. When the columns reached the edge of Barber's Wheat Field, and you just really need to know that that was a farm that was owned by the Barber family, they deployed into line on the gently sloping ground north of the main branch of Mill Creek. The infantry was then allowed to sit down in ranks, resting their muskets between their knees. The artillery went into positions which commanded the open ground in front of the artillery, and the gunners were at ease along their infantry comrades. The line was about 1,000 yards long, with excellent fields of fire to the front, and both flanks surrounded by thick woods. While infantrymen and artillerymen rested, they watched foragers out to their front, who were busy cutting wheat for the starving horses. The senior officers were also watching, their attention devoted to focusing field glasses and efforts to make out the distant American positions. The trees and distance prevented their seeing anything substantial. So the British and the Germans waited and rested. It was this waiting and resting that American Major James Wilkinson, Gates's aide-de-camp, observed when he was directed to check out the reports of outposts along Mills Creek. When Wilkinson reported the British situation, Gates was willing to listen to Morgan's recommendation that his riflemen and light infantry attack the British west, which would be their right flank. Gates directed Morgan to, quote, begin the game. He also saw the opportunity to catch his enemy on both flanks and ordered Poor to coordinate his brigade's attack against the British left with Morgan's. So Poor is going to attack the left flank, Morgan is going to attack the right flank. The overall plan called for both of those forces to slip through the woods and fall upon both of the flanks at the same time. Morgan started first, since he would have to slide out and make a wide turning movement through the woods to get into his attack position. Poor's brigade, which was about 800 strong, consisted of New Hampshire Continentals of Cilley, Hale, and Scammell, and militiamen of Livingston and Von Cortland, and Cook's and Latimer's Connecticut militia. The brigade's numbers included many veterans for whom the shorter march and quiet deployment was an easy task. At 2:30 that afternoon, Poor attacked, attaining complete surprise. His men had to attack uphill in the open, but they swept up the slope without firing. Major Auckland's grenadiers loosed off a hurried volley, which was followed by an artillery volley with grapeshot, but both of those volleys went straight over the heads of Poor's men, who came on without hesitation. Auckland ordered his men to fix bayonets and charge the damned rebels. But before they could charge, Poor's men, who had held their fire until its effects would be murderous at a short range, fired. Scores of redcoats were mowed down, among them Auckland, who took rounds in both legs. The whooping Americans, carried away with their success, were unstoppable. Infantrymen surrounded a 12-pounder, whipped it around, and turned it on the fleeing British. Auckland, lying helpless on the ground, was taken prisoner. As Poor's attack went in, Morgan unleashed his riflemen on the opposite flank at Major Balcaire's rear. Morgan had made a wide sweep through the woods, and his attack had come on with such suddenness and viciousness that it unnerved the British, and it delivered a crushing blow that was timed beautifully with that of Poor's. Major Balcaire's was in the act of shifting his light infantry companies to repel Morgan when Dearborn came up in time to deliver a smashing volley at such close range that the British light infantry fell back with their formations shattered. The gallant Balcaire rallied enough of his men to make another stand along a fence line, but in a matter of minutes, Morgan and Dearborn's men were sweeping around both flanks and coming over the fence. The British infantry finally broke and fled in confused disarray back to the Balcaire's redoubt. The artillerymen joined the flight as well, but they forgot to take their guns with them, which then left them for the Americans to take. Now it was Riedesel's turn. Holding the middle of the three groups, he could see the flanks around him beginning to sweep away. He looked around, saw that no British support was coming from flank or rear, and he had received no orders to retreat, so he and his men would stand firm and hold their ground. And while Riedesel had not received orders, it didn't mean that orders hadn't been given. Burgoyne had indeed sent Sir Francis Clark with orders for a general withdrawal after learning that the left and right flank had been broken. But Clark was seriously wounded and captured before he could deliver the orders to Riedesel. To To his immediate front, Riedesel could see an American force advancing to the attack. When it came closer, the German general could see an American general on a tall brown horse was leading the force, shouting and waving his sword to rally his men forward. The man on the horse was none other than Major General Benedict Arnold, who held no formal command and had decided to act 100% on his own. Gates had learned of Arnold's leaving to the battlefront and had ordered Major Armstrong to order Arnold to stand down and return to camp. But all Armstrong ever saw of Arnold was a cloud of dust and the rear end of a big brown horse. Arnold galloped past cheering Connecticut regiments, then past the flank columns of Learned's brigade. When he came to the head of the brigade, Arnold placed himself in the front of the foremost regiment and called out, "Follow me, boys." And follow him they did, across Mill Creek, up the facing slope to run head-on into Colonel Speck's waiting Brunswickers. The steady German regulars stood fast, firing disciplined volleys until the Americans broke and fell back. The Germans continued to hold their position against renewed American attacks spurred on by Arnold. His presence among the cheering troops was increasing the pressure on the Germans, and it became evident that they would be cut off. Fortunately for them, the order finally came for a withdrawal, and they fell back to the cover of the entrenchments. Arnold, riding back and forth to observe the action, caught sight of his opponent, British General Fraser, doing the exact same thing. Arnold saw that Fraser was the heart of a stiffening British defense. Fraser had led the 24th Regiment up to reinforce the light infantry companies he had rallied, and with them he was reforming into a new line. Arnold called over his old friend Daniel Morgan and said to him, "That man on the gray horse is a host in himself and must be disposed of." Yes, Benedict Arnold did just give a kill order on an enemy general. Morgan called up Tim Murphy. Now, we haven't heard much of Tim Murphy, but Tim Murphy is actually quite famous in this battle for what he's about to do. Murphy was one of Morgan's best marksmen, and he was a noted Indian fighter, and he was also known along the frontier for his famous double-barreled rifle. Murphy climbed a tree and sighted down on the British general. His first two shots were near misses, both almost grazing Fraser's horse, and one of Fraser's aides saw that his general was a target and suggested he move out of range. Fraser was a rugged Scot and a veteran of a dozen battles and disagreed. His presence had already proven its worth, and he knew where he was needed the most. Murphy's third shot felled Fraser. The bullet passed through his body, mortally wounding him. And when the word of Fraser's fall spread through the British infantry, the line that Fraser had tried so gallantly to restore collapsed, and the British ran to take cover behind their entrenchments. Now, at this point in the battle, a lesser general would have been content for his troops to pull back, reorganize, and remain masters of the field. And if Horatio Gates had commanded on the field, we can speculate that things would have probably ended that way, with the withdrawal of the last British units to safety. But Gates was not on the field. Benedict Arnold was on the field. And it was that fact that would turn Bemis Heights into a decisive victory. As Sir John Fortescue in his work, A History of the British Army, put it, "With true military instinct, Arnold seized the opportunity to order a general attack upon the British entrenchments." Arnold then personally led the assault on the Balcarres Redoubt. The Americans were met with such a fierce fire that at first it seemed like they would be stopped in their tracks. Arnold got the leading ranks into, and almost through, the tangled defenses, but they took such severe losses that they were forced to pull back. And when he had time to survey the situation, Arnold saw that nothing was to be gained in mounting another bloody assault on the front of the redoubt. And while he was looking around in preparation for his next move, he spotted Learned's brigade heading northwest towards the British right. Arnold mounted his horse and rode directly across the field of fire, coming out unscathed to take command of Learned's troops. Arnold's quick eye saw that the objective of his next attack. He led them clear of Balcarres' redoubt, passed beyond its right to spring up on the two stockaded cabins between the Balcarres and the Bremen redoubts. In one fierce rush, the attacking Americans cleared the cabins and the area of the Canadians, and the way was clear for a breakthrough on the British right. First, however, Arnold saw the chance to destroy Bremen Redoubt, at the extreme right of the British position. He found that Morgan had gotten his men around the British right and was ready to attack again. Arnold directed Morgan, reinforced by the regiments of Wesson and Livingston, to attack the redoubt and flank and rear, while he, Arnold, would personally lead an assault against the right rear of the redoubt. His assault force was already in hand in the form of Brooks's Massachusetts Regiment. He led them around the redoubt and forced his horse through a sally port. As he made his entrance, his horse went down from a bullet wound, and Arnold himself took a bullet, one that fractured the thigh bone of the same leg that had been shot at Quebec. Now, almost comically, as Arnold was being carried off the field, and I picture this happening in some type of crude stretcher, or maybe on the back of a wagon, Major Armstrong was finally able to catch up with Arnold, and he delivered an order from Gates, which ordered Arnold to return to camp. I don't know, I just find that funny. Back to the heat of the action, German Commander Bremen had fallen, mortally wounded by one of his own men after using his sword on four others to drive them back into the fight. With Bremen's death, the remainder of his small command gave up the redoubt to the Americans. The way was open to the British right rear, and the rupture of Burgoyne's line that Arnold had foreseen was now possible. But there was no Arnold to organize and lead that final strike. Consequently, there was no continuation of the attack. It was getting dark, and the only action that ended the day was a minor counterattack led by Colonel Speck at the head of some Germans in an effort to retake Bremen Redoubt. Instead, Speck was taken prisoner. So ended the Battle of Bemis Heights. British casualties for the afternoon totaled 600, and the Americans totaled around 150. It was obvious even to Burgoyne that his whole fortified line was no longer tenable. That night, the night of the 7th to the 8th of October, he pulled his entire force back in a well-controlled move to positions north of the Great Ravine. There, on the heights behind well-fortified lines, he could reorganize while simultaneously protecting his supplies on the ground, his artillery train, and the boats. On the following day, the Americans moved forward to occupy the low ground along the river as well as the abandoned British campgrounds. While Burgoyne appeared to be offering battle in his new position, that too appeared impossible, as American forces had begun moving up to the east side of the river. Now what follows is best summarized in Sir John Fortescue's A History of the British Army, and I'm quoting from that now. Burgoyne found himself compelled to retire up the river to Saratoga, abandoning some 500 sick and wounded men to the enemy. The retreat itself was accomplished without hindrance, but so heavy was the rain and so severe the weather that the men on coming into camp had not strength to cut wood or make fires, but threw themselves down, old soldiers though they were, on the sodden ground to sleep. When the light came on the morning of the 9th, it revealed the Americans in the act of entrenching the heights on the opposite side of the river, so as to prevent the British from crossing. Burgoyne therefore decided on the following day to abandon his artillery and baggage and to withdraw by forced march to Fort Edward. Scouts, however, came in to report that the whole of the fords on the road were beset and that the Americans were strongly entrenched with cannon between Fort George and Fort Edward. The British were in fact surrounded. Gates had, by this time, from 18 to 20,000 men. I'm going to break my quotation here. That's from John Fortescue's number, and that's a little questionable, but Gates did outnumber Burgoyne at this point. Back to the quote. For yet a few days, Burgoyne waited in the vain hope of news from Clinton, but the message had been intercepted and the messenger hanged. The army was not only surrounded but starving, and on the 14th, Burgoyne made overtures for a capitulation, aka a surrender, which was finally concluded on the 17th. It was agreed that Burgoyne's troops should march out with the honors of war, pile their arms, and be conducted at once to Boston for shipment back to England, on the understanding that they should serve no more in America during the continuance of hostilities. And just like that, 5,721 British soldiers, including 7 generals, 27 cannon, and some 5,000 firearms, and all of the army's other materials and ammunition, had been taken out of the war. The fledgling American nation had been dealt a tremendous hand. Now, will they double down and go for broke, or will they fold? We'll find out next week. If you think that today's episode was worth a dollar or two, why not head over to the website and donate to support the podcast? Visit AmericanMilitaryHistoryPodcast.com and click on the green button that says Support the Podcast. There, you'll be able to give recurring donations with Patreon or single or recurring donations with PayPal. The podcast is listener-supported, so every little bit helps, even if you're just buying me a cup of listener-supported coffee. And yes, this is coffee this time. Past couple episodes have been water. I'd like to thank my donors for this week. Charles W. donated at the specialist level, Claudia F. at the private second class level, John C. at the sergeant level, and Mark B. set up a recurring donation at the private first class level. Thanks to all of my donors for the support that you give. It helps keep the podcast running. And thanks to all of you who have set up recurring donations. Thank you for honoring your donations this month. If you do decide to donate, you'll get your name on the website and also mentioned on future episodes. To stay up to date with the podcast, you can follow the podcast on Facebook and Twitter or with the email newsletter. Links to all of those are on the website, or you can search Facebook and Twitter for American Military History. Thanks to all of you that follow the Twitter account, and thanks for the retweeters this week, at JimYat11, at Stephen Perez, at 3PerSergeant, at Hawkeyes99, at JSD82C, at Morpheus43, at MLunyon, at Extra Dividends, at SquidzillaStein, at DVOrlando. If you would like the illustrious honor of having your Twitter name mentioned here, just retweet one of my tweets to your followers. It's that simple. Hey guys, guess what? We have hit our review goal. Yay! As of this recording, on Wednesday morning, we're sitting at 76 reviews. Our target was 75. This final push was made possible by some 5-star reviews on iTunes from BGSoccer49, PU1972, Howley Toner, Craig V, and Wayne Jameson. Thanks to everyone, all 76 of you that have reviewed the podcast. I really do appreciate it. If you're not able to financially support the podcast, I understand that, but reviewing on iTunes is a fantastic way to support the podcast for free. But 76 isn't good enough. We need to get to 100. That's our next goal. I want to get to 100 reviews by the 1-year anniversary of the podcast, and that will be on July 4th. So we've got about 3 months, about 12 more episodes to get there. So let's shoot for 2 reviews an episode, and we're set. That's it. So if 2 people right now just go review the podcast on iTunes, and you can do it right there from the app. If you do it, we're set. And speaking of goals, I've got one more. We're currently at almost 250,000 downloads. As of right now, it's about 220,000-ish total downloads. By the 1-year anniversary, July 4th, let's see if we can get another 100,000 downloads onto that. So I want to try and hit 350,000 total downloads by July 4th. Now, what that means is you've got to keep listening to episodes, but you've also got to share the podcast with all your friends. Shoot them a note on Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. Post it on Tinder. Maybe you get people to swipe left or right or however that thing works. I don't know. I'm married. I don't use Tinder. But together, we can grow this podcast. Let's do it. Let's try and get another 100,000 downloads. All right. That's going to wrap up this week's episode. We finished our discussion on the Battle of Saratoga. And next week will be just as good. Until then, stay safe. Take care.